Look, I'm a big fan of designing your own life. And again, it feeds into a lot of what I'm trying to achieve with Gigable, is allow people to design their own lives. Mm. It's coming back to my own path as well, like moving from a very, very structured environment of, would say, the Defence Forces to kind of an unstructured startup environment in many respects.
The two couldn't really be more different.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. I'm your host, Gary Fox. Couple of bits of housekeeping before we start this week. On December 4th in Dublin City Centre, we're having the Entrepreneur Experiment live. I'm going to announce our second guest today. Last week, we announced Devin Hughes. He's going to be on there on the night with us. And also Gareth Flower from Park P&P. Gareth has just moved to New York to crack the New York market and the US market for Park P&P with his brand new product, which he'll tell us more about on the night. In the meantime, go to Gareth's Instagram, Gareth Flower, and check it out. He's vlogging kind of every day on his journey and his challenges. Super interesting for anyone thinking about moving into a new market. So check that out. He'll also give us the full rundown on the night of what it's like to move to a new market. So if you do want to come, go to my website, mrgaryfox.com, mrgaryfox.com. And there's a button up the top saying EE Live. Go there. Tell me how many tickets you want. There's a limited number, about 25, 30, depending on the venue. And there's probably 50%, 60% gone already. So if you are interested, log on today. Fill out the form, come along on the night. I'd love to meet you. Secondly, the first ever Ideas Lab has been recorded this Thursday in Dublin City with Mr. Dave Delhunty, who is an extremely popular guest. He was on episode 3, I think, if you want to go back and listen to that. We'll be chatting all new trends, ideas for 2020, recording that this Thursday. I'll put it up on Instagram Live as well, and that'll be released next Tuesday. Now, to this week's guest, John Ryan from Gigable. John has launched a brand new platform for a whole new way of work. So anyone familiar with the gig economy will kind of get it instantly. But John is pushing far beyond that into like a flexible workplace solution, whereby if you want to pick up work for like a day or a week, John's platform is allowing you to do that across many industries, and they're launching out into many others. So John's a really interesting story. He was actually in the Irish Army for 10 years. So we touch on that, but it was a really wide ranging chat. Identified hugely with John and a lot of things, the way he thinks about things and how he approaches things. And we really dug into a lot of detail. So you're going to learn a huge amount about discipline as an entrepreneur, how you can apply that. And it's not just, you know, having a structure versus having a discipline. You're going to learn about how to set up a tech company without having any experience. So John says himself, he had no experience in setting up a tech company before he started, how he went about that, how he approaches that on a day to day. And you also learn how his company runs completely remote. So they rarely come to the office unless there's a specific need for them to come in. We talk about ketogenic diet, we talk about training, we talk about books, everything. It's a huge, wide-ranging chat. So kick back, enjoy the episode of Mr. John Ryan from Gigable. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Gary. Thanks for having me.
So we've been chatting about this for a while. It's actually good to get you on. So give a little intro as to what you do.
So I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Gigable. And I knew you'd ask me this question to start, so I'm going to avoid the banal answer of Gigable is a mobile platform that connects X and Y. And to just kind of briefly introduce what the gig economy is. And, you know, obviously the name of the company is Gigable, and that's because we operate in the gig economy space. But for a lot of your listeners out there, and for people in Ireland in general, I think they kind of know, or they're familiar with what it is, but they don't really understand it. So I suppose, in my opinion, what the gig economy is essentially a natural development of how people work that's very closely correlated to advancements in technology and, you know, changes in societal attitudes, you know, generational shifts as well through Generation Y and Z, or Millennials and Generation Z. And essentially what Gigable is then, to get back to your actual question, is a platform that is trying to be the model of, you know, transparent and fair gig economy work. And that's really what we're trying to do, is build that model across, you know, a wide range of industries. Primarily at the moment we're operating in delivery, and we can talk about kind of happenstance later. It wasn't really planned that way, but we kind of got pulled into delivery because there's a lot of on-demand work in that space. But primarily in delivery and hospitality at the moment is where we're at. But really the kind of the vision for the business, and we can get into this a bit more down the path as well, is to be a model, kind of like a utility almost, for independent work that people can use in whatever way suits their lifestyles or whatever way suits their business. And in the middle, they'll meet in the platform that we're building, hopefully. So that's scalable.
Nice. So it's a very balanced answer. You didn't give me the PowerPoint slides.
No.
It's, look, I love this. This is kind of like a selfish episode for me. I love this industry. I'm in it a little bit with the sharing economy with Airbnb. So I was fascinated. We had a coffee a few weeks ago and I was fascinated about everything we were chatting about. So when people think of the gig economy, what generally, you know, if people aren't familiar with it, what is it?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there, because obviously there's a lot of, you know, work is very important in people's lives, obviously, and there's a lot of people who feel that the gig economy has been designed by, you know, Scrooge McDuck or whatever, sitting on piles of cash, and has gone, how can we screw workers? It isn't really like that. It's actually developed and is born out of a demand from the worker side, in my experience and from, you know, research as well. In as much, if not more so, than from businesses trying to squash people into a gig economy model. Because a gig economy model is not easy to run either as a business. You know, you've got people on demand, they can work when they choose. You can't plan effectively. Your cost centers are harder to predict and harder to control. So it's not the all singing, all dancing solution for businesses or for workers in the current guise. But I think generally out there, people understand the gig economy as being, you know, guys riding around on bikes, delivering your pizzas and your Chinese takeaways and stuff like that.
I think that's the most visible aspect. So that's what people see. And I think it's a lazy stereotype that the media use as well to characterize it. We see it all the time with Airbnb, greedy landlords, making a profit, when in actual fact, that's maybe 2%.
Yeah.
Same with gig economy. I'd imagine it's a whole other range of people working in the gig economy. So what else can the gig economy be?
I mean, like, for me, essentially at the broadest point, it's a way that people, and I know empowered is a word that is overused nowadays, but it's a way essentially to empower workers to work, you know, to their own schedule. And, you know, in today's day and age, when people, you know, before the podcast started, we were talking about diets and training and stuff like that. People nowadays, especially the younger generation, have a lot of ambitions outside of work, you know, be they physical fitness or, you know, personal interests, art, music, whatever the case may be. And really, the traditional 9-to-5, as boring as this concept is at this stage, because people are always talking about it, the traditional 9-to-5 doesn't suit modern lifestyles. And technology has slotted in recent years to allow people to not have to work a traditional 9-to-5 and earn as much in terms of their income or even more by operating in a higher, like a more effective way at higher value gigs, depending on whether, you know, it's in IT or consulting or whatever else, which are kind of lesser known gig economy on demand businesses, but also very, very much on demand work driven. So I think that if there's a good model built for it, which there isn't at the moment, in my opinion, particularly for in-person work, which is what we focus on. So the Gigable platform isn't about, you know, hiring a freelancer in Lahore, Pakistan to build your website. It's about getting a guy to come to your coffee shop to help you serve coffees or to get a chef into your restaurant at the weekend or delivery as well at the moment. But what we're already looking at and having conversations with people in the pharmacy industry, consulting industry, the health and fitness industry, coaching, where there's generally just an on-demand nature to the work. People need a model that's really, really easy to plug into so that they can do this independent work. They have no interest in being employed by the business or the individual that's putting up the gig, in our example. So I think that it has the potential. Like, obviously, I love it. I think it's amazing because, like, for me, I became obsessed, we'll say, 4 or 5 years ago with this idea of being untethered to a job, for lack of a better description. So not having to be, you know, in a job like 9-to-5, gold watch kind of a job, paying into, you know, the company pension and going to the whatever the company parties and all this kind of stuff, and just being a career man, you know, with a particular industry, because I get bored quickly, I'll be honest with you.
Standard entrepreneur.
And I think a lot of people get bored quickly, actually, but they just like 9-to-5s and jobs or whatever. And it depends on the temperament of the individual. So that suits some people and they're happy to do that. They clock in and they clock out and they go home and they've got their other lifestyle or whatever.
And that's fine too.
Totally fine. Totally, I actually respect that, and I kind of envious of that in some ways.
I literally had this conversation with a friend of mine the other day. We're having the exact conversation. We're going, sometimes I wish I could switch off. Yeah,
exactly. Like, it's definitely an easier life, you know. Being, you know, involved in the gig economy or being an entrepreneur, which are closely related as well, and we can talk about that maybe down the way in the podcast too. But, you know, if anybody said it to me, I genuinely say to them, you know, take a very, very close look at what you're doing if you want to get into entrepreneurship or whatever. And this is a little bit of a digression, but you know, get your head examined first, because like you're talking about being on 24/7 basically, whether you choose to or not. Like people, you know, they need answers on the weekends or the nighttime or whatever, especially if you're in the on-demand economy space as well. Like it pretty much is a 24/7 endeavor. But on the flip side of that, it's also unbelievably rewarding, because you're doing something that you should be doing something that you're really passionate about, and the work no longer becomes work. It's a passion, it's an endeavor that you want to pursue to the end, you know, to kind of see it work. But yeah, there's a lot of potential downsides there in terms of your own personal time. And like, I don't really have a social life. I don't mind. I had a good social life in my 20s, which I parked a few years ago, and I was quite happy that to kind of just dedicate myself to something else, you know. But you want to be kind of sure of that, I think, before you step into that space.
Yeah. I actually had this conversation again with a friend of mine. She's thinking about starting her own business. I asked her, what does she want? What does she want her life to look like? Because a lot of people get excited about a business idea and just the idea.
Mm-hmm.
This is my idea, this is what I'm going to do, but don't think of all the knock-on effects of what will that mean. Will I be on 24/7? Or will I have to, you know, be in an office? Or will I have to travel? You know, what do you want your life to look like first?
Yeah.
And then build out what you want the job to look like, in the career to look like, in the business to look like. Because if you don't, you start the business and then suddenly you're on this path.
Yeah, you just get pulled down rabbit holes left and right.
And you know what that's like. You're in it right now. You are just 24/7.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's the rare bird that can step back and put his head above the grass, or her head above the grass, and say, you know, this is not what I set out to do, and I need to take a step back, or get out of this rabbit hole and go back on the path. We'll say if it's in business or in your career or whatever else. But you won't know. It's impossible to know what that path is completely, right? But you will know what the why is, why you're doing it. And you will know what kind of drove you initially to start that endeavor or to start that path, be it your career or your business or personal life, whatever the case may be. But it is good to have an idea of like, what does success look like, you know, in 1 year? Like I had an idea of what success looked like for Gigable in 1 year. And thankfully I've just blown that out of the water, thankfully. But now I'm like, okay, what does it look like in the next year? And it's like, how am I going to get there? Like, what do I need? And just like basically plan it out. Like you don't need to write it down. Like people are talking about journaling, whatever. I tried it. I don't really need to journal. It's kind of in my head all the time. Maybe journaling would.
That's
would
a blessing help. And a curse.
Yeah. So I kind of don't need to write it down. Sometimes people like do lists or whatever of what, you know, 6 months, 12 months, whatever else. But definitely you need to have an idea of what success looks like for you in your business or for your personal life. And like ideally for me, like what I want to achieve with say Gigable for the worker particularly. And like when I had the idea, I was always looking at it from the perspective of the worker. It was like give them unlimited opportunity, you know, so that they literally can earn an income doing what they're good at whenever they choose to do that. If there's enough volume in the app and there's enough volume in the platform that people can tag in and out of meaningful work as suits them, you know? So ideally, what will that result be, we'll say in 4 years' time? So success for me would be that people are actually working less, but being paid more because they're doing things that they're effective at. And the costs for businesses will be able to pay people more because they don't have four people to do a job that should require two who are effective at what they're doing and want to do it, right? Which is a big issue in businesses as well, is that, you know, you kind of have to have, you know, generally speaking, you need to have four or five people to get maybe one or two really, really good ones, and then two kind of average ones, and then everybody else pulls the, you know, the final piece of the puzzle along. And that's very, very difficult because it drives everybody's pay down as well. It drives everybody in the business's, you know, effectiveness down. And a lot of the time, it's not because that individual who might be the top performer in the company or whatever the business might be, it's not that there's anything wrong with them per se. They just don't want to do that job, probably. You know what I mean? And that's an issue of choice, and it's an issue of availability, and it's an issue of, you know, the facility of technology not delivering to those people yet, but it can in time. And that's what we're looking to get into, is giving kind of unlimited, like endless, I suppose is a bit of a kind of a highfalutin word, but it basically endless opportunity to people to earn income doing things that they want to do. And, you know, that might be an idealistic goal to set, but it's good to have idealistic goals, because if you get even halfway there, you'll have made a big difference.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, I think you have to have best case scenario.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're just aiming for the middle ground, and that's kind of nothing.
Yeah, and I often, you know, often people often say to me, look, they say, John, your idea for what this app is, should be is, you know, it's never going to happen because it's too idealistic. You know, there's never going to be kind of perfect competition and people aren't going to have perfect opportunity and equal choice and whatever. And I totally accept that. You know, you need to be pragmatic as well. And, you know, aiming for the 4-year dreamline target today would be totally, you know, inappropriate because we don't have the capacity, facility, the money, volume, you know, everything, brand identity to do that yet. So, excuse me. So the early step is let's get volume in here and let's get like 100 people who really love what we're doing, including businesses, we'll say. So we'll get like, let's say 100 businesses and we've got 4,000 people, give or take, on the app at the moment, right? Registered, verified members. So we'll say, let's get like 1,000 workers and 100 businesses or something like that who really, really get it and really, really love it. And let's just learn from them and develop the perfect world for them as much as we can. And then let's see if that's something that we can kind of push out into other areas and for them to then be kind of, you know, in their own rights, the champions of it, whether they won't see themselves that way. Obviously, they'll just be like, we're just using this because we need a solution to our problems or whatever. Yeah. It works, exactly. And then you take that, you learn from it, which is what we've done at a very, very rapid pace in Gable. We've, you know, we were very, very lucky before we even had an app. We had customers doing delivery for us, myself and Shane Gannon, head of partnerships in the companies, and with me since the very beginning, basically. We had a spreadsheet of names and phone numbers of guys that we got from an ad on Gumtree who were interested in doing delivery work. And we had two clients who needed delivery guys on demand. And we were ringing them and getting them into gigs around Cork, as it was. It was just where the opportunity arose for us.
I love this. So you hacked together your first.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was like that for 5 months, 4 or 5 months.
I love that.
Yeah. And it was tough going. Shane bore the brunt of that.
So you basically found a couple of customers who were like, yeah, we use delivery drivers all the time. Trouble to find them. You went in, found delivery drivers who wanted work.
Exactly.
You sat in the middle and then you just logistically worked it out.
Just put them together, put them into gigs the same way the app would eventually do come April or May of this year when it was live. It was live on the Play Store in January of this year, but wasn't on iTunes until April, I think, or May. Basically, so we didn't really push the app until we had it live on both, because it was like the business was like, well, I'm Android, but the guys we want are on iPhone and we can't connect to each other and all this. And we were just like,
oh, why was the delay?
iTunes just, you know, is a lot more rigorous check of the apps, which is good, actually. Like, you know,
you hear that a lot, that Apple push back a huge amount.
They push back a huge amount and we were like cursing them. But at the same time, I was going, actually, that's a really good point. We didn't think of a way to flag a gig, and you should have a way to flag a gig. For example, somebody puts up a gig for something crazy, like whatever, use your imagination. There's no way for people in the community to tell us.
Okay.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were you don't think about that when you're thinking about the ideal solution. You're not thinking about it. Nobody's going to misuse
this. No bad actors.
Yeah. There's no bad actors in the world, you know, but there are, unfortunately, and iTunes know all about them, or Apple know all about them. So they gave us some good kind of, pushback that allowed us to develop the app or whatever in a kind of a good way that made it really market ready. But those early days, as I said, we were trying to build an ideal solution. We were lucky that we had real customers with real feedback that we could feed into the development process like straight away. Mm. Started the company in August.
What did they think you were doing?
The businesses?
The customers, yeah.
So I don't think they cared, actually. Yeah. If anything, when we moved them to the app, they were kind of resistant. Because
they were used to you picking up the phone.
Yeah. It was like, this is really easy. We just call John or call Shane and tell them we need 10 guys on Saturday or whatever. And it was, way easier than posting your own gigs or whatever into the platform. So, but they got it in time. And, those early customers are still with us. And they're using it in such a way that they actually don't need any more features or they're not demanding anything else. It does exactly what it's supposed to do, which is great. You know, it just kind of runs itself. And the guys who are earning an extra income, you know, doing delivery work, are just tagging in and out of gigs as they want to. And, you know, some guys pull down $2,500-$3,000 a month doing delivery, supplementary income, you know, to their day jobs or whatever. They got kids or whatever. That's an amazing feeling. Actually, I love that. That for me is like, when you're struggling and you're thinking, well, you're making a decision about the business or development of the app or what you can do to make it. I'm always thinking about those guys. I'm like, you know, kid needs braces, whatever. There's something going down. I need to do some repair work in my house or whatever. And somebody goes, yeah, I'm going to tip into the gig economy and, you know, make a few grand extra this month or next month. Those are like, and actually, you know, statistics would tell you that, you know, that's only maybe 15-20% of people in the gig economy are doing work in that way, where they kind of tagging in out because they just need whatever, a bit of extra money. It might be to go on holiday, it might be something quite, you know, quite kind of a normal thing to do as well, as opposed to an emergency need of funds or whatever. But yeah, a very small proportion, seemingly, if you read the stats, around 20% are doing it for those reasons, whereas around 70% odd are doing it for out of choice, or just as, you know, a kind of a regular supplementary income to their lives, as opposed to kind of tagging.
That's very surprising.
I'm very surprised at that as well, actually. I think statistics, you know, statistics are statistics.
yeah. They can prove anything or disprove anything.
Yeah, exactly. Was it lies and damn statistics?
Yeah, but I think that, I think that's a media thing as well, in terms of, I think the gig economy has been characterized as this exploitative, I've no choice, so I'm going to work in the gig economy. Whereas, yeah, it's now been proved 70% of people are actually doing it by choice.
Yes.
They want to earn a little bit of extra cash.
Exactly.
For fundamental things.
Exactly. And like, you know, there's, you know, up to half the working population in the US and in Western Europe, you know, by McKinsey's estimates, are involved in the gig economy in some way or other at this stage.
Without probably realizing it or calling it the gig economy.
That's exactly
making it. Making a few extra quid.
That's exactly it. And I think that a lot of people are choosing to move to independent work anyway. You know, I know people who are in, we'll say, the consulting profession, the accountants, auditors, pharmacists even, who are very, very interested and have, you know, there's a lot of appeal in being able to do what they do best, be paid more for it on a day rate or a week rate or a 3 month, 6 month contract, whatever it is, or gig, as we call it, is basically like a little mini contract. And to be able to live their life as well, you know, at the same time, without having to clock in and out to be showing face. You know, it's a deliverable based system, really, the gig economy. Like you're, you know, outside of, we'll say, food delivery and whatever else, like hospitality work or whatever else. But if you're looking at kind of higher paid independent work, it's generally project based. And it's, you know, you're given a result to achieve by a certain date. It's what you're good at and it's what you like doing, and how you do it doesn't really matter. It's how we run that's how our whole team runs in Gable. Like, I don't have anybody come in at a certain time unless we have a meeting or something that we have to do, which is pretty rare. People, it's project based. Like, this is what we need to achieve. You do it whatever way it suits you. You know what I mean? So we drink our own Kool-Aid.
I was going to say, you're eating your own soup or drinking your own Kool-Aid or whatever. Yeah. Say, that's interesting.
Totally. Yeah. You have to, like, you have to live by what you're preaching, and then you can see the downsides of it. Sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes people need more direction. A lot of the time it doesn't suit certain people. Like, they're not used to that kind of level of freedom.
I think that's it too, in terms of this is very new.
Yeah,
this is very new. Look, I'm a big believer in that. I think it's the future, so I'm sold on it. But I think it is very new to a lot of people. I think it's disjarring for some of the people. You know, some people need that, like, I have to be there at 9 and I can leave at 5 and I have all that time in the middle. You know, I think it's very, you almost have to think, you touched on earlier, you think like an entrepreneur effectively.
Yeah.
You own your own business to a point.
Exactly. And that's actually, the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor released a report this year, and they've added a new category of entrepreneur, which is gig economy participants.
Interesting.
So they've actually just officially gone, actually, no, there's just too much crossover here. If you're a gig economy worker, you're essentially your own business. And essentially, like, the UK are a little bit ahead of us, you know, say legislatively speaking, and models or whatever over there are a little bit more advanced. And they essentially allow people to register as a freelancer, you know, which is what we call the workers on our platform now. So you can register as a freelancer, and it's quite normal culturally to manage your own tax, manage your own work, tip in and out of contract work, either supplementary to your day job or as your primary source of income. It's quite normal culturally over there. I think here we're a little bit behind there, where people's heads kind of start to get a little bit fuzzy when you say that. They're like, really? Is that something that you can? It's like, yeah, you can do that. Like,
is it legal? Will they know?
Yeah,
all this kind of thing. There's an Irish aspect to that as well.
And that's because a lot of it exists and has existed in the past, we'll say, in the shadow economy. Like, you know, that this work is not new. I know, like you said, like, it's a new way of doing it because technology's given new ways to tap into it, but it's actually not that new, really. It's been going on for a long time that people would do independent work. I suppose historically speaking, organized work and being the kind of gold watch job, you know, company man, is kind of a modern phenomenon in many ways, and things are going back to the, we'll say, the way they might have been pre-industrial revolution or whatever. Now, which is, you know, people working for themselves, being independent, not really reporting 9 to 5 anywhere. I think that that's actually kind of the new thing in the kind of a grander context or whatever. But
when you say shadow economy, what do you mean?
I mean, like, you know, we need somebody to come in last minute. You're not going to put them on the books for a night or a day. It's just going to be 50 quid or whatever. So we're bringing that element of work into a model as well that makes it transparent and makes it totally, totally above board, which, you know, previously it might not have been, you know, in a lot of cases. And there's no way to really measure that. I mean, there are statistics on it, and like people do try to measure, but it's really, I think it's probably finger in the air in a lot of ways.
You hear statistics every year. It's usually around this time of year, actually.
Yeah.
You hear mad statistics.
Yeah.
You know, hundreds and hundreds of millions. And that's, I would imagine, true.
Yeah, it's possibly, it's hard to know, really. But I mean, there is a model, and I think, to be fair, it is very easy to have a PAYE job and to go onto revenue and register that you've earned an additional income and report that as an additional income and pay the tax on it. It's quite normal. It's a question that I get all the time, and you know, I'm not trying to hide from that at all. Like, this is gig economy work that people do supplementary to the PAYE job. Revenue, to be fair to them, have made it very, very easy for people to register and to report that income separately and pay the tax on it the following year. Now, you do need to go online and whatever, click a button or two, but you could literally do it in 5 minutes. And there are plenty of accountancy firms out there, which I do myself. I don't want to do it myself. Say, here, will you look after my tax reporting there for last year? This is what I earned in PAYE. This is what I earned in tax. Or sorry, I'd say independent work or self-employed work.
Yeah.
And just look after that for me. But I think a lot of people in Ireland, culturally, as soon as they hear the word revenue, the hairs stand up on the back of their neck, and they're just like, I'm going to get creased here because I'm definitely doing something wrong. And generally speaking, people, you know, anecdotally anyway, as I'm told by people in the profession, in accountancy particularly, people way overpay tax when they have to do their own reporting, because they're so concerned. They don't claim their expenses. They don't, you know, take advantage of the benefits of being a self-employed individual also give you. And they end up paying way more tax than they should. So I always recommend to get one of the accountancy firms who specialize in this, pay them €200 or whatever it is to do your tax for you for the year, and just, you know, rest easy.
A good accountant is worth 365 nights sleep. It's amazing.
There is.
It really is.
Yeah, and I think there's definitely, like, it's something that I'm constantly like answering this question. People just assume in Ireland culturally, you can't do this. And it's like, you can do that. Like, there's models there. Like, there's a system there for people to be allowed to earn additional income. And if you don't make it easy, which is another thing that we're trying to do, we're trying to make it really, really easy for people in the platform. So like when you earn anything in the platform, you have a full transaction history, the date you did the gig, how much you got paid, what our fee was, what the VAT on the fee was, all that stuff is there at a click of a button for you to pull down.
Okay, so at the end of the year, they can just go on a Gigable and they can pull out their kind of end of year return.
They can do it whenever they want to.
That's a good idea.
And after every gig, both the business and the freelance worker receive to their email account a PDF, like receipt, like a paid invoice, basically. It says all the details. This is the business. This is the freelancer. This is where it happened. Location, how much the value of the gig was. The full record is there. So we're like, okay, there's a way to do this the right way. The right way, like, I don't mean morally, but I mean the right way in terms of how you can actually report and do gig economy work and earn additional income without being nervous that you're...
Take the fear out of it.
Yeah, take the fear.
That's the key.
Exactly, yeah. So like we said, okay, what else do people need? They need a record. They need PDFs. I know myself, you search your emails for gigs that you've got. You're like, there's all my PDFs from Gigable. Yeah. Okay, so now I can do my records. This is what I'm going to forward to my accountant. And what's an easier way, again, if you're kind of, would say, a little bit tech savvy, or you can use Office, well, I want a spreadsheet of all this stuff. So we go, okay, let's just create a spreadsheet for everybody that has everything, their full records available to them, that they can pull down from the app, all their data of all the gigs they've ever done since the time they joined up. There it is. There's a total number, and they can just manage their tax that way, manage their affairs in a kind of, again, it's transparency piece is huge for us. It really is, like, you know, giving people the transparency, the oversight over their own work, over their own lives, and be able to manage it, give them the tools to manage it themselves well. And I think that the vast, vast majority of people out there want to do it the right way.
I think a lot of people are coming to it new as well. They're coming to it brand new, fresh. They might have never had a business, or they might never had kind of a an understanding of how to keep books or how to keep taxes, or, you know, so I think there's an education piece for you as well there.
Definitely, yeah. We're actually partnering with an accountancy firm to write blogs and posts about, you know, and like, you're not from the point of view of selling gig, it was like pros and cons of doing independent work. You know, things to look out for, important dates in your calendar, you know, when should you be filing by, this kinds of stuff, just to give people the information, because I think there's a bit of an information vacuum here.
Definitely. It can be confusing as well.
It can be confusing. Very confusing. It can be confusing. You know, revenue have made it very easy for people, but it should be easier. You know, I would love to work in a way that allows us to just upload directly for people on their behalf into revenue.
That would be great, yeah.
And just take all of the work out of their hands. You know,
well, you need a VPS number, really, in theory.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Just connect into an open API, you know, with revenue and just upload for people on their behalf what their gig economy earnings
That'd
were.
Be super.
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely, you know, there's no reason. I don't believe that people in general want to avoid their responsibilities as citizens, you know, when they're working. And I think that everybody, including workers, like businesses, is this legitimate? How can I do this legitimately? And I have that conversation with people all the time. It's like, this is how you do it legitimately. This is how you look after it. This is how you get your records from our app. This is what I recommend, is use a professional, pay them the 100, 200 euros, whatever it is, to just go through your stuff for you, because they'll do a better job of it probably. Mm. And they might save you some money as well. And then people are like, oh, okay. Mm. This isn't actually the demon that people have described it as, you know? And, you know, I suppose from you know, the government's perspective and revenue's perspective as well, like this is like a natural evolution of work. And to build systems, it's basically a business model, right? Revenue's a business. It's a business model.
It's an effective one as well. They're damn efficient.
Right, exactly. And they need to be. And like I think that, you know, building a business model that is more inclusive, not less inclusive, by kind of, you know, we'll say outlawing, are trying to make it difficult for people to do certain types of work, is not the, if you're thinking about it from a businessman's perspective, as we say, you're in revenue, you're a businessman, you're saying, okay, how can we widen our net?
Yeah.
How can we make it easier for people to be compliant?
And that's more income as well.
And how can we make more money, basically, which is totally, like, that's the reality. They need to pay for public services and everything else. And I'm, you know, 100% behind that endeavor. Okay, we need to make it really, really easy for these platforms and for people on these platforms to pay their tax, like click of a button easy, you know what I mean? So that's not such a big kind of a daunting thing that they're running away from because they don't understand it, you know, in the vast majority of cases.
So take me back to starting Giggle. Were you working in the gig economy?
No, actually, I wasn't working in the gig economy. So my background is a little bit meandering, I suppose.
This is a super leading question.
yeah. It's a little bit meandering, but I suppose there's been themes running through all of the jobs I've done that are still true today and guide what I do in Gigable. But I did finance in university, in UCC. I worked as a stockbroker briefly in Goodbody Stockbrokers for a year as an equity analyst. Which actually I really enjoyed. I've still used a lot of the skills that I learned in doing, you know, building financial models and doing equity analysis. And
that's looking very interesting. So it was Connor last week as well from Matic. That's so interesting. Right, okay. Very similar background to you.
Yeah. That was great. Really tough. Like, it's tough work. Like, you're long hours. You're in the office before 7 and you're leaving at 7 or after most days of the week. That would be kind of the norm. But good, very, very rewarding. And I was very, very fortunate to have worked with Colin Hunt, who's now the CEO of AIB. He has actually recruited me into GoodBodies that time. So I had a bit of time working with him around 6 months or so, kind of in a mentorship capacity, which was fantastic. So I was really, really fortunate to do that. After that, I decided to join the army. So watched too many movies as a kid.
I was going to say, there's a big change.
There's a big change.
Stockbroker's the army.
Yeah, I wanted to do something that's, and I still do, I'm still constantly trying to challenge myself, you know, intellectually, physically, in all kinds of ways. And I think, you know, that was just like, it was just an itch I had to scratch. You know, I had to do it. It was just, you know, there was something about the appeal of throwing, and I suppose I'm still kind of like this, throwing yourself, you know, uncompromisingly headlong into something that's, you know, you're completely committed to it and you're going to do it no matter what, come hell or high water, kind of a thing. So with that, I joined the Irish Army Cadets and I got commissioned in 2010. And then, so I was in from 2007, yeah, training till around 2010. Suffered a couple of major injuries during my time in the Army, back surgery, broken legs and stuff like this. So I had a bit of a longer time. during training, I had a discectomy on my back when I was in training in the cadets. And the army were fantastic. Like, they looked after me while I was out getting surgery and all that. Like, I just thought, that's it, my career is over.
Were these training injuries, or were these genetic? Or
I think it's like, I've had a, you know, there's a kind of a few people in my family who've had back injuries and back surgery. I've had two uncles who've had similar surgery, so I presume it's a combination of the both.
Okay.
It's probably like, you know, crazy training plus, you know, genetic.
Bit of David Goggins-esque turn to this story.
Maybe I wouldn't compare myself to David Goggins too much, but there's definitely certain similarities there, I suppose. Yeah, so a couple of injuries later or whatever, got commissioned in 2010, served in Cork, 4th Battalion in Cork, which is unfortunately no longer there. It was an infantry battalion in Cork City there in Collins Barracks for a number of years. I loved the army, absolutely loved it. It was a really, really tough environment in many respects. Like, training was really, really hard. And really, like, as we say in the army, the real army was kind of like you're in the training environment and it's kind of like you're getting ready to go to war, and everybody's super disciplined and you're lined up and you're getting inspected and you're going on training exercises and stuff like that. And that's the kind of the army that I loved.
Yeah.
Then there's like the day-to-day army where you're doing like kind of the job of being in the army, which is very, very similar to a lot of public service jobs. Really, it's kind of a clock in, clock out kind of an environment, you know, and it comes with its bureaucracies and its kind of slow moving, you know, environment that can be very difficult if you're the kind of person who likes to affect change quickly.
Sitting here with you now, I struggle to see
I look back as well and I go, wow, how did I actually, because I was in for 9 years in the end.
Like, that's a long time.
It's a long time to be in, yeah. And I can, every time I say it, I'm kind of going, wow, I was in the army for 9 years. And that's always going to be who I am, really. I'm always going to be an army officer. Like, that's it. It's just part of who I am. I was there from 21 to whatever, 30 years old. And, you know, it's hugely formative years. And I wouldn't change that because I learned incredible discipline, ability to plan, you know, just a kind of a general aggression towards tasks. Like, I'm going to nail this.
That's a great way of putting it.
But like, aggression's got a bad name, but aggression is super important.
You need it, yeah.
Aggression is super important. Like, as long as it's controlled, like, aggression, like, aggression can be conflated with, like, being, you know, unreasonable or, like, shouting at people or something or losing your temper.
But you see it on the road every morning. You see people not able to channel aggression. They've no outlet. They've no gym. They've no boxing class. They've no running.
Exactly.
And they're just sitting in their cars silently raging at the world every day.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, like, learning to control your aggression, and the army actually is fantastic for that because, you know, despite what people think, and you think, like, Full Metal Jacket or whatever else, like... Really, the army gives you a lot of space to learn, especially as an officer training, we'll say, to learn how to have a mission that is essentially an aggressive mission. Okay, we're going out there to destroy the enemy or whatever. But to really look at it in a measured way, how are we going to do this with the minimum loss of casualties or minimum use of resources if you're in business, the most effective way and the quickest way? And you can kind of apply that across business and across everything. But an undercurrent to that is learning how to kind of act with speed and aggression. And, you know, in business, you know, especially in pretty much everybody I speak to when they talk to me about Gigable, like, you know, senior business people or investors or whatever, they're like, you need to move fast with this thing. It's like, you need to go quickly because this is like an exploding space. There's people looking at it. You've got a foot up now in Ireland in terms of like, you're kind of the only really effective model here. And I would argue we're kind of the only effective model in the way that I described earlier in the conversation anywhere, actually. And we can get into that as well. But, you know, the scaling of this is really important, and scaling it quickly and aggressively is really, really important too, and in a disciplined
way. That's a good thing to hear, though. You don't want to hear like, oh, you're a little bit early on this. I can see where you're going, but a couple of years maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, no, that's a great thing to hear. But it's also like you need to, it kind of just reinforces what I already knew, which is we need to do this quickly, you know, if we're going to be the model. A bit of a digression there. But yeah, I was in the army till 2016. And then I did an MBA in Smurfit.
When did you decide to leave? Was there like a moment, or was it like a gradual thing over time?
I think that we'll say the first 3 to 4 years I was in, I was army barmy, as we say, completely mental. I went home at the weekends and I was you know, preparing my kit and organizing my gear for the following week, that kind of stuff, you know. And
I'd imagine it's hard not to be. I'd imagine it's hard not to get swept up in it.
Yeah, yeah. Some people, I suppose some people joined to be like the 9-to-5. They knew what the real army was, as in they knew the kind of regular day-to-day army, what they knew what that was. And they're kind of going back into, you know, that's what they joined for. And that's fine, you know, because the people, you know, you need people to run the army too in a regular, it's a big administration unit, a lot of it, you know. So that wasn't for me. Like, I always wanted to kind of be into the kind of the thick and heavy stuff as much as I could. I suppose the shine kind of came off it over time. There was a major restructuring. I think it was in 2012 or 2013, like, if I remember correctly. Major restructuring of the army. Units were closed. There was a lot of misinformation and just lack of communication with officers and people in general in the army. It was just a really horrendously managed restructuring. Horrendously managed. Like, we were finding out what units we were being sent to from other officers, like of our own rank, without being told. Like, four battalion officers weren't told by command where we were going for months and months and months, and then we just knew we were going to be shipped somewhere in the country.
Okay, and nobody knew. I was like, just curious, where you're going is in the department or in the country? Or
no, in the country. In the country. Like, wow. So you didn't know what unit you were being posted to. What, you know, it was just a really, really messy time.
And so
was,
you were in Cork?
I was in Cork.
And you're from Cork?
I'm from Killarney. From Killarney originally, yeah.
Okay.
So I was based in Port Town there. That was really badly managed. Personally, I had kind of gone through a lot of injuries as well, that serious injury, and I was training really, really hard for a lot of courses, and I broke my leg then later on, which was really disappointing. I was on a course I really trained hard for, and I broke my leg. Then I was on another course where I got really, really sick, basically, kind of, you know, the back was broken on something, and then you kind of fall out of it. And I was like a little bit kind of just not disgruntled, but that's a completely wrong word, but like disheartened. I was disheartened, and I was like, okay, I'm not getting any younger here. The shine has gone off this thing a little bit. I've really broken myself up a lot doing this kind of training for a while. And I started to kind of just become interested in developing. Like, a lot of what I was focused on for my early 20s and mid 20s was like physical development, developing that leadership ability in the army. And being able to, you know, plan and be disciplined and kind of drive myself in that kind of a way, not very intellectually heavy. And I had kind of an interest. So I went to Lebanon and I was there for 6 months. And while I was there, I was just kind of researching. I was like, what other stuff could I be interested in? You know, that, you know, what have I not done since before I was in the army that's still important to me, or stuff that I might have even forgotten about? And actually, okay. And actually, I kind of went, you know what? Actually, I used to love being creative and like learning new things, you know what I mean? Like outside of army stuff or whatever. And I started just to kind of read business books, and I decided to kind of look at, you know, different kinds of jobs that are out there, like consulting. It's like, oh, people get paid to come in and solve problems in a business sense. And I was like, well, that's really cool. And I was really interested in doing that. I said, okay, I'm not going to make the leap from army officer to, or I felt I wouldn't anyway, to kind of getting into a good job in industry like consulting without doing some kind of further education first. So between the jigs and the reels, I was looking at different masters and all that kind of stuff. And I knew a friend of mine who had done an MBA in Smurfit. So I had a chat with him and I decided, yeah, actually, this is the way to go, because it's kind of an MBA is, it's brilliant if you're kind of a jack of all trades type of person, or if you want to have a lot of variety, because you do basically a few different masters on the course at the same time, but you're not an expert in any of them. You just have a very good understanding of accounting, strategy, corporate finance, human resources, the whole spectrum. And I was like, okay, that's kind of appealing to me. So I went to Smurfit, did that. I was fortunate enough to get in, did it for a year full time. It was really, really interesting experience. Really, really enjoyed it.
Intense, I'd imagine.
Very, very intense, which I was kind of used to, actually. So
yeah, it ticked all your boxes. Very hard, very challenging, grueling. Yeah.
But I think, you know, obviously, like, when you come out of the army, I think a lot of the people, and myself as well, you underestimate, actually, how different you are to everybody else. Like, you're wired completely different to regular people, or as we call them, civvies, civilians. You are just wired very, very differently. And everybody's wired very, very differently anyway, like just as a general rule.
You mean in a discipline way or in a mindset way, or what way do you mean?
Both, I think. And like the way you would approach tasks, you know, and like that might just come across differently to somebody who's not used to approaching things in a kind of, let's say if you're in charge of a group project or something, you're just like, okay, you're going to do this, 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 because I've already decided that you're best, that's what you're best suited for. And we're going to meet up at 0600 tomorrow.
You'd kill on The Apprentice. I'm watching it at the minute. There's an Irish girl on, a Pamela Laird, and I'm watching it. And I think you'd be maybe next year.
All right. Okay, I'll take a look at that. But yeah, like, people aren't used to that. I think in general, and this is, you know, I'm not saying this is the right, there's no right or wrong way here. Like, as long as you get the right, the good result, or the result you're aiming for.
As long as you do it my way.
But, yeah, but, and my way is definitely completely evolved since then. Totally evolved. And that's something that's important for anybody.
I was going to ask you that. What, is there a massive transition from going from the army into, you know, a civvy street in terms of like doing a master or an MBA with people who are very, very different to you?
Totally, totally. And that was like a lot of the students on my course, the full-time course, would have been, you know, not from Ireland. So there was a lot of people from India on the course. There were some Chinese people on the course. There were people from South America on the course, North America, Canada. That was great too, because you get that real international flavor, which is something I wasn't really kind of used to in that regard as well. And it taught me to be, you know, over the course of the year, it taught me to be much more open-minded about approaching problem solving. You know what I mean? Like, you, I had a way of approaching problems and solving problems, which worked and is effective, but people have other ways that are completely different that also work and are effective. And a lot of the time it depends on the group you have, if you're doing a group project, or it depends on the type of project you're doing. Is it something that requires more creativity? Then people need space. If it's something where it's, you know, it's deadline driven and it's kind of, you know, it's a work project, it's a workhorse kind of a project, then it's kind of, you need somebody to take control, take leadership, and just go, okay, you're doing this, you're doing this, you're doing this, and everybody knows the need to do, and off you do it kind of a thing. So you need to adjust your style of leadership, and you need to adjust your approach to problem solving depending on the problem. And that sounds kind of obvious, but I think a lot of people don't do that.
How did you do that?
I think rather painfully, just by learning from things that didn't work, you know, and being in groups where I was like pulling my hair out going, why is this guy not doing this the way I told him to do it, or the way we said we would do it? And then just learning, you know, throughout the year, that, oh, well, because he's got a different way of doing things, you know. And, you know, sometimes you'd be kind of going, yeah, I still think my way is better, but it got done and we did it a completely different way than you had planned, but you learn from that. And I guess, you know, you have conflict. You have conflicts with people, of course. Like, you're in a high intensity, like, the full-time MBA course is really, really tough in terms of volume of work. It's not really, you don't need to be a genius to do any of it. Like, you need to, you know, have a general ability across the board, but like, you don't need to be a genius to do an MBA. You just need to be able to manage a lot of work simultaneously and kind of hit targets and whatever else. So, you know, in that kind of an environment, you're going to have conflicts. And like, I would have had like, you know, nothing major, but I would have had like little mini conflicts with people on teams that I was on where, you know, you're just, I suppose when you believe in something, right, the more, like, I can't remember where I heard this recently, but the more beliefs you have, the kind of stupider you get, because
I like that,
because you become automatically close-minded. Yeah. So I believed that my way was the right way. And that meant that I was closed off to other ways of doing things generally, right? And once you kind of tear that down, you suddenly become more open-minded and you become better at what you do over time, but you will have to go through painful processes there. You'll have to have conflicts. You'll have to, you know, approach things in new ways that you maybe don't necessarily think are the right way. And they mightn't be the right way. They might be the wrong way. You might get the results you want or whatever, but you need to kind of just let that go and be dedicated to the process, as opposed to the goal. So it's like, being goal oriented is great in one way, but in another way, sometimes it's not so great. If you're more dedicated to the process and the development of processes to achieve the goals, then you're probably going to have, you're going to be more open-minded, because you're not going to be, you know, as kind of singularly focused on a goal, no matter what, you know, kind of Machiavellian style. So
how long was the MBA?
So it was one year full-time. Great time, really, really loved it. It was one of the best years of my life.
So definitely. You moved Cork to Dublin,
yeah. Living with my brother during the MBA. Basically, yeah, it was kind of in the college every day, working at the weekends. It was my first taste of kind of my current life, which is 7 days a week working. And
you don't seem like an ideal guy. I can't exactly imagine you.
I know, I need to
kick him back.
I need to build in more idleness, actually, I think, but I'm trying to, because idleness is important too sometimes.
I want to chat to you about training actually in a minute, but just bring me then up to speed on how did you get from there to where we are?
Yeah, so I met a fintech company while doing a project on the MBA course here in Dublin. Went to work for them as COO for a couple of years.
Okay.
Company grew quite a bit in that time. It was three times the size it was when I came in. It was really, really small. So I was in there for approximately 2 years, and that was great. Got a great feel for kind of startup environment. Like, I knew nothing about tech. Like, let's just put that out on the table. Like, I knew literally nothing about, I knew smartphone apps insofar as the ones I needed for my own personal life.
You could use Google Maps.
I didn't even know what the gig economy was when I started the MBA. That's like, really, I'm talking about completely raw. Like, I hadn't a clue. But I went in, and boy, was I voracious when I went into the MBA. I was like, I was just a man on a mission. I gave up my social life very soon after finishing the MBA. Basically, I gave up drinking 3 years ago. Gave up smoking 3 years ago, which would have been things that have been quite normal in the army kind of lifestyle. You know, you work really hard, but you also party really hard. And like, when you have time off, like, you know, you're R&R, you're going partying, and where are we going to go? You know, this kind of stuff.
That's interesting. The environment shapes the person. I often think about that in terms of like big company versus small company. I used to work in a big company, and it was like Thursday drinks.
Yeah,
and that was the thing you did, because you needed to blow off steam.
Yeah.
Then you were dying on Friday, and then you'd be just going through the week, and then drinks again, and there was a lot of social events, things like that. So it's interesting when you actually leave that, you're like, oh.
Yeah, there's you can design your own life. Like, I'm a big fan of designing your own life. And again, it feeds into a lot of what I'm trying to achieve with Gigable, is allow people to design their own lives from a works perspective. And that's genuinely a big driver for me. And it's coming back to my own path as well, like moving from a very, very structured environment of, would say, the Defence Forces, to kind of an unstructured startup environment in many respects.
The two couldn't really be more different. Like, you've gone from a very structured environment to creating a platform to let people have as little structure, as more structure as they want.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think back, and I think of you, I think of that quote from Jocko Willink about discipline equals freedom.
Yeah.
I've that written on my, such an odd thing to say, I've that written on my protein jar at home. And because I see it every morning, it's just sitting there in the shelf. But I do believe that, like, the more, you know, if you have discipline, you get what you need. You know, when I hear you talking about, you know, I do my task is done. Well, then you don't kick back, I kick back. But when the task is over, I'm like, done. Yeah. I kind of have that mindset whereby things niggle at me, things keep eating away at me if it's not done.
So before I like you that. Do it, is it like, is
no,
it,
when it's, if it's not them done, like, okay, so you know, the last couple of days, I have a load of stuff on my plate at the minute, and they're just niggling away at me.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking about them, thinking about them, thinking about them. But if I just sit down, power through them for 3-4 hours, and they're done, then I feel the freedom.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's trying to get that balance though.
It is. It varies person to person. You know, some people, like, and I really, one thing I discovered when I went back, would say, to the person I was pre-army, is that I actually really enjoyed doing creative kind of things, just like drawing and this kind of stuff, you know, or writing stories or writing scripts. When I was a young kid, I used to love very young, when I was 12 or 13, I remember writing movie scripts because I really wanted to write movies, you know, and I was like, I completely forgot about that.
It's amazing how that creativity drops off.
It does, yeah.
And you still have it in you, but like, you just don't give yourself, I think it's time. You don't give yourself that time.
Exactly.
This is free time.
Yeah.
Whatever, like almost like a childlike state.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, to touch on what you said there about the discipline equals freedom thing and Jocko's kind of whole doctrine, I think that certainly is true. And I think it's alarming, actually, how much people misinterpret what that means. I think, you know, I used to be one of those people, obviously, like, you know, anything I'm saying now is because I've experienced the pain of true learning to get to where I'm, what I'm saying right now, and you know, I've got a long way to go yet and a lot of things I need to work on still. But I think a lot of people mistake being disciplined with being regimented. And like, being regimented and being disciplined are very, very different. Like, regimented means I'm going to get up at 5:30 and I'm going to walk the dog, and then I'm going to have my breakfast at 6:01 and I'm going to be in the bus by 6:10.
Boring. People think it's boring.
It's boring, but
that
it's
guy
also
is dry as whatever. It's just, they confuse it with like the old man with the pipe. Oh, I love my routine.
Yeah.
And if he breaks his routine, it's exactly what you're saying though. It's how you shape it. What is
exactly. So like, I actually have relatively, I suppose it depends on what's going on or whatever, but my life is relatively unregimented.
Okay.
But very, very disciplined in that I will get things done on time, or like, you know, without fail almost 100% of the time. But I might get it done at 10 o'clock at night when I should have, you know, if I planned it you know, the week before, I would have done it at 6 o'clock in the morning or at lunchtime or something.
That's interesting. I thought you would have been the opposite way around.
I've moved gradually from less regimented, more disciplined in terms of target discipline, achieving targets, as opposed to doing things at a certain time. Or, you know, even like nowadays, I try and say, okay, Monday is product day. Today I'm just doing product. And like inevitably, you know, things come into the sphere that kind of stop you spending the whole day on working on the product. But I still get the product things done that I want to do. It's just because I'm disciplined about hitting those targets, as opposed to being regimented and having a schedule, a structured schedule or a strict schedule that I have to stick to, because strict schedules are almost impossible to stick to, especially if you're an entrepreneur.
I've tried it so many times.
Yeah. And then you get disheartened and then you go, this is not realistic. I'm never going to do this. And then you go down that spiral of it's a waste of time. And then you're kind of going, you're back to square one. Mm. Whereas if you, in my view, anyway, what worked for me was it wasn't me that said that. I can't remember who said it to me. Somebody was like, there's a big difference between being disciplined and being regimented. And I went, ding, whoa. That's true. Mm. And I was like, okay, I can still kick ass and be super disciplined without having this like rigid structure to my life. And that was a major turning point for me, was learning that. And I think it's a good one to kind of keep in mind for people as well, that they don't get the two mixed up, you know?
That's really interesting. I'm a bit of a planning nerd, productivity nerd. Like I used to do that. I used to be like, I'd make out the week and I'd have the timings done, and it never worked. Worked for the first couple hours. And then phone call. 20 minutes. I budgeted that 20 minutes. I need to get back on. I have my 45 minutes of social media I need to do, or financial accounting, whatever it is. But yeah, now I chunk it. I just do the chunks of like, I need to do 2 hours of like today.
Yeah.
Very exciting day. I've got to do my expenses.
But
I know I'll do it. But like, I'm chatting to you, then I'm gonna get lunch, then I'm gonna meet the guy too, and then I'll probably do it between 3 and 5.
Yeah.
But it'll get done. If not, do it in the morning. You know, it's just, know what you have to do, I think, is more important than having the strict times of when you need to do it.
Yeah.
I think that's key. Talk to me about training. I'm going to self-indulge myself here.
Physical training.
Physical training. So you're into training and diet heavily.
Yeah, it's for me, it's like a must have, you know, like in terms of, it's like a daily holiday for me to be able to go to the gym for half an hour or an hour, or to go for a run or whatever it is I'm into at the time. And with training, I'm a jack of all trades as well. I've gotten too bored of things too quickly to stick with them.
Yeah, ditto. I've done about a million different things. So what's getting your attention at the minute?
At the moment, I suppose I've kind of gone back into just focusing on like what I'd be kind of strongest at, or what I'd be best at, and focusing on your strengths more than your weaknesses kind of a mentality is just like gym work. Like, I enjoy doing the gym. It's what I would have gotten into like the earliest days of what I would have been training at. Like, I would have played soccer at a competitive level when I was a young, you know, teenager or whatever. Mm. But, you know, from kind of late teens onwards, it was always just like going into the gym and Arnold Schwarzenegger's bodybuilding book and pumping iron documentary was watched probably 20 times, if not more, realistically. I think for me, you know, being an entrepreneur, being a person, a founder, particularly, and listening to James McCormick's podcast yourself, I think you were talking about the difference between being a business person and being an entrepreneur. Mm. I'd agree with a lot of what you said as well. As an entrepreneur, it's as much a personal development journey, in my view, as a business journey, than anything else. Like, it's you need to prioritize your personal development. You need to be, you know, totally open-minded to new ways of doing things, even if they mean that the current way you're doing things is wrong and you need to change up what you're doing. And you need to look after your you know, be it spiritual, intellectual, physical development in coordination, or in tandem with your development as a business or an entrepreneur, because in my view, you're never going to achieve the heights that you could in business, from my perspective. Maybe other people would have a different view, unless you're focusing on yourself as well in the background and developing yourself.
I agree completely. I think James is probably the perfect example there.
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever met an entrepreneur who's so focused on that side of things.
Yeah.
I think he's gone down, he's had his own journey. If anyone wants to go back and listen, it's James McCormick, the Barista Baron. His episode is fantastic in terms of personal development. But I've never met someone who's so focused on looking inward at what he needs to do to make sure he's happy, fit, healthy, and able to do business.
You know?
And I think in that order.
Yeah, you need to look after, like, it's become boring, kind of a cliche thing to say this is, but you do need to look after yourself as well, in terms of your, for me personally, intellectual development. So like, my weekends involve you know, I'll do a bit of work at the weekends usually as well, but like what I consider part of my work is reading material or reading books by people who know more than I do, who've learned and who are in the game of business or whatever it is for significantly longer, learn from their mistakes. The best mistakes to learn from are other people's mistakes, you know what I mean? And apply those learnings immediately, if necessary, into your own business. And that's a responsibility you have to your business. So like my whole weekend just gone, I probably did between 10 and 12 hours of learning / creative hours, which I track every week. I track how many learning and creative hours I do on a day-to-day basis, including my training and everything else. So
how do you track that?
I have this complicated kind of complex spreadsheet that I've built
over. You made it yourself?
Yeah, okay. That I've built over a long time, years probably, where basically I'm tracking how many hours did I spend reading or learning and creative hours, how many hours did I spend doing health and fitness related things. It could be a walk, gym, you know, going to the sauna, whatever, that kind of stuff. Did I turn off my phone before 11 o'clock or before 10 o'clock at night? Because I, you know, it's a really bad habit having the phone on, like, you know, and, you know, having an hour before I go to bed where I have no screen time. So between 10 and 11, something else I track. Then I just have like general tracking. So those would be kind of like metrics. The diet, am I on track of my diet? They're kind of binary, one or zero scores in the sheet. And then I also have a category that's like feeling related. So it's a, what's my happiness levels like today? What are my energy levels like today? What's my clarity level like today? And they're on a range from -2 to +2. And then I have scores that I'm trying to achieve in each particular day. So they all feed into a kind of a algorithmic is a fancy way of saying it's an equation, basically. An equation that leads to a score that's either above or below a threshold that I'm trying to achieve. And then recently, I would say probably around 3 or 4 months ago, I've been doing the ketogenic diet for 4 or 5 years on and off, pretty consistently at different times, depending on what's going on in my life and where I've been. For example, like when I was in Lebanon, I couldn't really do it too consistently. I didn't have control of my food. But,
and hummus is amazing.
Nowadays, I'm able to do it a bit more consistently. And I started tracking my blood glucose and blood ketones level with the blood testing kit. And I just see where I'm at on a day-to-day basis. And what I'm trying to do is collect enough data about myself that over the course of a year, I can say, okay, so my thesis is that if I'm doing the ketogenic diet and I'm turning off my phone before 10 o'clock at night and I'm getting to bed before 11 and I'm doing, my target is 10 hours of learning and creative per week and 10 hours of health and fitness training per week.
Right? It's pretty good.
So if I hit those targets and I'm like charting this or whatever, then presumably the thesis is that my feelings of energy, happiness, clarity, and whatever are all going to be through the roof, right? Yeah. There's going to be a nice hockey stick there from starting point to where I got to.
I like this. This is logical, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there's always gaps in the data where you're like, I was so under pressure last week at work. The whole week was a write-off. Diet was down the toilet. I just had things to get done and I didn't have time for this stuff. And that happens. Like sometimes you got to roll with it. Like you can't just say, sorry, no, I have this, I had to get to bed before 11 last night because it's, you have to, like, you're responsible for the founder. So you need to get things done. And sometimes you have gaps in the data or whatever, but just smooth those out and see, yeah, there is a correlation here. And for me, definitely correlations happen in terms of the ketogenic diet with energy and clarity and general kind of happiness and kind of focus levels are certainly higher once you get into it, once you kick into it. And I know you've kind of been playing around with it yourself as well recently.
Briefly explain to people, just in case you're not familiar, what ketogenic, I think it's so popular now, I think everyone is.
Yeah,
it's like a really quick explainer.
Yeah, it's essentially you're switching from being a carbohydrate-fueled diet, which in many respects is kind of like a petrol diet, to a fat diet, which is a lot more slow-burning fuel. That allows you to have less peaks and troughs in blood sugar, essentially, in your body. Better insulin sensitivity. So I heard a really good way of describing it recently, because I do cycle in carbohydrate depending on how much training and stuff I'm doing.
I was going to ask you that, because that's something you see people struggle with, is how do you sustain such a, like, 10 hours a week, is it? Training? That's a lot. That's taxing in the body. So how did you do that?
From a diet perspective, I do cycle in carbohydrate. I just found from tracking, where it would say tracking my, this is one of the benefits of tracking your information and data analysis, is that I noticed that at 100 hours approximately, it was 4 days basically, from the point of starting a ketogenic diet. So we'll say I get into ketosis really quickly at this point, and get into ketosis within like 12 hours, we'll say, which is because I've been doing it for so long. If you're just starting out, it'll take you a bit of time to adapt or whatever. But we'll say I found that 3 or 4 days into that, with my regular training schedule, we'll say of an hour to an hour and a half a day, right, of fitness training and working, we'll say between 10 and 16 hours a day, which is probably the average I would work as well, on top of learning, that I would just find that I would need to rebalance hormonally, which actually fits in with the science of a ketogenic diet as well. And I just go, I'm going to have a carb load meal, whatever carby meal I want after 100 hours. And I would find that doing that for me personally, like a four day, 100 hours basically, at 100 hour point, eat what I want. And then the following day, I would just be like on fire, like with energy.
Okay.
Because I'd be, my body, like scientifically, your blood and your whole adrenal system, your nervous system, your whole system is super sensitive to insulin at that point, because you've been so steady and level because you're on a ketogenic diet. That I heard it described recently as like caffeine. If you're drinking 6 cups of coffee a day, the marginal benefit of an extra cup of coffee
so much
is like zero, if not negative. But if you're treating your carbs like caffeine, right, and you're like, I'm going to have a cup of coffee. I don't generally drink coffee that much, but I need to smash something today. I'm going to have a strong cup of coffee, whatever, 200 milligrams of caffeine or something like that, right? And you're going to be like, you're going to be flying, you know? And I treat carbs kind of the same way at the moment with training, and I find it really works for me. It doesn't work for everybody, definitely, and diets are person specific. No one diet, including the ketogenic diet for myself personally, I've kind of tweaked it to suit my own lifestyle and my own, what works best for me. But definitely that kind of premise of having a steady blood sugar, lowering your carb intake and lowering your kind of caffeine carb mentality intake, like you kind of earn your carbs or use them only when you need them, definitely for me has resulted in much, much better longevity of focus, we'll say, and being able to just really kind of just perform better in general, be it physically or
and you track that, you track all that, you track your clarity, you track your performance.
Yeah.
And how do you fast then on top of that in terms of...
Yeah, the keto diet's a fasting diet. You know, you're not really, you're not going to eat, you know, 6 or 8 meals, small meals a day on a keto diet generally. Like I don't know anybody who does that. So generally I would eat like 1 to 2 meals a day, like kind of a larger meal, whatever, that's kind of high fat, protein, vegetables, stuff like that.
What does that look like?
So it could be like, you know, a fatty ribeye steak and some stir-fried greens, spinach and broccoli or something like that. You know, pretty basic. A keto diet is kind of a basic diet in many respects. You don't really, it doesn't really involve a lot of fancy sauces and stuff like that, because it's just hidden carbs and preservatives and all kinds of stuff in all that stuff that you want to stay away from. It's a super, super clean diet. So yeah, I would fast, generally speaking. I haven't eaten anything today. I probably wouldn't eat anything till maybe 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock this afternoon. It should be a 16 hour fast, I think. Yeah, so 16-8 is generally like,
yeah, you hear that fasting quite a lot. Yeah,
a lot of people are getting into intermittent fasting these days on its own, whether they're on keto diet or not, which is you just don't eat for long periods of the day, be it 16 hours or whatever suits your life. But generally I would be kind of a 16-8, 16 hours fasting and an 8 hour window where I'd be eating. But again, work just destroys all these things. Sometimes work comes in and just goes, nope.
Yeah, you're out of my mind. I was going to ask you about the, you know, work. Yeah. I mean, you're busy. How do you balance that off? Is there trade-offs there you have to make?
But the trade-off always has to be in favor of the business. You know what I mean? That's your number one responsibility. You've got people working with you. You've got people using your platform. You've got businesses relying on you. So it's always going to take priority. You know, that's the kind of sacrifice you make. You know, people describe it as your baby. It kind of is, like, you need whatever it takes. You're gonna give whatever it asks for in terms of your energy, in terms of your time, in terms of your attention, all those things that are people are constantly, you know, trying to ration these days, because everybody's trying to, you know, get your attention and trying to suck your time off you and suck your energy off you. So you need to kind of ration that. But when it comes to your business, it kind of all the rules are out the window, and if something needs to be done, you need to kind of give yourself and your time to the business kind of unconditionally in many respects, which is a downside to something we were talking about earlier, the disciplined versus regimented approach.
Yeah,
like a plus side of being a little bit more regimented for me that I could probably improve on, I think, going forward, and I'm working on now, is I'm regimented about making sure that I do have downtime where I'm not checking my emails and checking my messages and working every day of the week, which I have been doing since I started Gable August of last year. I'm trying to now go even just a half a day, like 12 hours, like on a Sunday, where my phone's in airplane mode and I'm just reading, and I'm going for a walk, and I'm not listening to a podcast or whatever. I'm not going to be involved in something that has me thinking about my responsibilities. It's really, really important. And I think you have to do that over time. Everybody you'd read, I'm reading Ray Dalio's book, Principles, at the moment, and he talks about doing 80-hour weeks, and he says it's just not sustainable. Like, no matter...
You can do it. You can, like I did when I started Host Brothers. Yeah. I literally, the office was sitting in now. I used to spend crazy hours in here. But there is a time, and I mean, I burnt myself out completely. We did about 18 months of just, as you're talking about there, there's an element of you have to do it at the start as well, because you have to get off the ground. You mightn't have staff. I didn't have any staff at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't work with me, like you're saying there. It was getting done or it wasn't, especially with us. We'd cut clients to let in, people look after, people arriving from the airport. It was getting done or it wasn't, and it was on me. But after about 18 months, completely crashed, just burned out completely.
I think 18 months seems to be a kind of a tipping point for a lot of people as well, actually.
Because you're running for 12 months, 18 months, you know, there's so much momentum behind you as well.
Exactly.
It's like anything. It's like a lot of people get sick over Christmas because they're working so hard, and then their body's like, now I can stop fighting off all the stuff I've been fighting. And it's the same with your mentality. It's kind of when, you know, when I hired some people to work with me, and then I was like, oh my God, I'm just completely zonked.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. But I think we touched on it at the very start. You don't really know what you don't know. You don't know, am I working hard enough? Am I not working hard enough?
Yeah.
Am I putting as much effort in as I should be? Where am I in the business? Am I at the stage where I should be handing more off? Am I not?
Yeah.
I think that takes a long time. And you probably overcompensate as well. You probably work too long.
Yeah, I think you do. And I think a lot of it is that, like, you just mean the best. You mean well.
Yeah.
You want to do the best for people. Like, I feel huge responsibility to my investors and my team members and people who've believed in what I've been doing, you know, and helped me out. And that's, you know, that can be a double-edged sword, because it can drive you to push yourself too hard, and nobody wants to see you burn yourself out. So you need to become really kind of ruthless in how you divvy out your energy credits, as I call them.
I think of, like, that's funny you say that. I think I started thinking about that as well recently. Yeah. So a lot of similarities here. Say you have 50 energy credits for the day.
Yeah.
10 of them on the gym, 20 of them on work. You know, you do. It's like a battery. I think of it, I love computer games, so I think of it as like a game.
Yeah.
You start off with a full energy pack, and that depletes over time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think the one that I'm trying to always build up, like we're talking about building up physically in the gym or whatever, and that's just like there's a pleasure complex to that as well. But I get as much pleasure nowadays, as much pleasure from building up intellectually and like my capacity and my level of facility in certain areas or by reading or learning something new that opens my mind to new directions for the company, for Gable, or for new directions in my own development as a founder. And that, it kind of gives you new energy. You know what I mean? Because
you have that moment where you're like, oh my God, that's exactly the problem I've been facing. The books are incredible.
Yeah.
It's the quickest way to like drain someone's brain. Like you have these geniuses like Ray Dalio or whoever it is.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God, that's exactly the principle. Because principles are the same. It doesn't matter if he's running a multi-billion dollar hedge fund or Gigable or Host Brothers or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Principles, business is business. You're dealing with people. People are people.
Yeah, and the journey that, you know, that's an overused word nowadays as well, the journey, everybody's talking about their journeys or whatever, and it's kind of gotten, you know, a bit banal or whatever, but it is a journey, and you are learning along the way, and it is full of pain and suffering, and like, but that's okay, because you know that you're going to learn, well, you should try to learn from that and come back on and be better individual from it. And I think a lot of people miss out on that. They miss out on learning from other people's mistakes, which, you know, reading books is a great way to do that, but speaking with other people as well, who are more than happy generally to help you out and teach you from what they've learned or whatever, from their painful experiences. But you especially as a founder, like if you're trying to avoid pain in your life, don't become a founder, because like you're going to have a lot of painful moments where you go, oh man, that wasn't the best decision or whatever.
That's on you as well.
Yeah, that wasn't the best use of my time, or that wasn't the best use of money, or that wasn't the best market to go for, or whatever. And you just try and limit your exposure. It's like, I think Principles is a great book. I'm not finished it yet, but it is a really, really good read, because, you know, playing the markets or, you know, diversifying your risk and not putting too much on one trade, all these kinds of market trading principles or whatever are applicable in regular life as well. Like, you don't want to put too much risk or too much time on one move generally, because if you lose, it's like catastrophic. You're out of the game. And you need to stay in the game no matter what, you know. So you need to measure your risk, and you need to diversify your risk, and you need to like, I suppose in the point of view of Gable, yes, we're big in delivery and we're big in hospitality right now, but for me, and always what it's always been, has been being kind of applicable across a whole range of industries. So we're looking right now, obviously I mentioned health and fitness companies on the platform. Like, great, that's like diversifying. It's a new space where people have a use for us. We're a utility to them in terms of getting a contract done or doing gig economy work and paying each other for that work. But like, where else would this be useful? Like, it's, that for me is a diversifying of risk, but it's also tying into the overall, you know, utility kind of a model of what we're trying to achieve as well.
So where is Gigable now?
Geographically, we're in, like, we're basically all, like, essentially we're all over Ireland. We just launched in Galway last week. We had a logistics company require truck drivers and general operatives leading up to Christmas and stuff like that. So we helped them source those and put gigs up on the platform for them. We were in Kilkenny during the summer. We started off in Cork, which is still kind of our biggest market. We launched in Dublin in, like, June, I would say. And we launched in Waterford at the weekend, actually, with the partner down there as well for delivery. But yeah, we're probably still our biggest market is Cork. All in all, a couple of big customers there. And then Dublin is kind of catching up at this point now. I think that we touched on an educational piece earlier and kind of an understanding in general around the market. That's a big part of what we're trying to do now, is that once people understand how to use our system, like the product level understanding, but kind of a cultural level understanding or a work environment or work structures understanding. Once people get that, they're like, oh, this totally works. And it's like, we don't even need, there's like no more touch points required for us in terms of kind of keeping people on the platform. They just consistently use it. They're just like, oh, this is so easy. This is great. And it suits me and it suits that chef. He loves doing gig economy work, and they have their own little relationship. And we just kind of see, oh, they did a gig together that weekend again. It's like, oh, that's cool. And we just had nothing to do there except provide them the tool.
So you build the platform. So your platform works essentially, I own a bar. I need someone for tonight. I post up the job. You want a gig. You're like, great, yeah, I'm barman, I can take the gig. You accept the gig, you turn up, do the gig, and then you complete the gig.
Yeah.
He gets paid.
Exactly.
Gigable takes a percentage in the middle.
Exactly.
And that's it.
Exactly. And okay. Everything we're doing is just about building up how good that is. And, you know, some people are asking for various different features. So, for example, the events companies that we work with, sometimes they need 50 people. They don't want to post 50 gigs. They want to post one gig that has 50 slots. So like multiple freelancers in one job kind of a thing. So that's something we're like, the hard thing with most of these feature requests is not the technical development of it. It's the UX of it. It's the front end look and feel of how it's going to work.
I get you.
So we've kind of cracked that recently and we're building that in. But yeah, essentially that's a good, that's a good kind of way of describing what we do. We're basically a very, very simple tool for businesses to post up a gig or contract or whatever they need done. And it could be chefs, delivery drivers, whatever. Physiotherapists as we've had on the platform recently. Other members of the community can then see that as an opportunity, apply to it. Once the agreement is made or the gig is confirmed between each other and it happens, the business gets to pay the individual in the app, as you said, and we take our percentage, and both get to leave a rating for each other afterwards as well. So it's a two-sided rating system. So we're trying to build up that level of community. At the moment, that's a binary kind of a system where it's like, I'm saying you're great and you're saying I'm great, which is kind of, you know, it's okay, but it's not the best kind of a rating system. Version 2 of the app that we're releasing next month has algorithmic score in there for each member of the community, business or freelancer. And essentially that's going to capture things like how responsive you are, how many gigs have you completed, what other people have said about you after a gig in terms of...
A whole picture, yeah.
It's a whole picture. So you, like, Gary Fox could have a score of 87 out of 100, which is, you know, maybe you got knocked down a few points because you cancelled a gig with short notice or something like that. So we built in a whole host of rules into the back end that are going to feed into this score for every individual member. They say, oh, that's cool. These are the factors that I can work on to improve my score.
Modernize CV effectively. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's a big, I often say that, like, what does success look like for Gigable in, say, 3 years' time for me is that people outside of the platform who've never used it will still understand and know that Gary's score of 87 is pretty good. Yeah. If you've done 1,000 gigs and you've got a score of 87, that means you're a pretty reliable dude.
Mm.
And people generally think you're good at what you do. And I think that's a big kind of a target that I'm driving for on the freelancer side, is that kind of recognition, that recognizability of the score that you achieve in the battle.
I think that's huge. Even that aspect alone, I think, is massive. I just think CVs are just bananas day and age. It's like, they may as well be written on a stone tablet for all the, like, the usefulness they are.
Yeah.
I like LinkedIn. It's good, but there's still...
It's all what you say about yourself. Yeah, it's what you say about yourself and what other people say about you, less to a much, much lesser extent. And it's a lot of it's kind of back-scratching. Like, I'm glad you brought up LinkedIn. I often see if we hit what we're trying to hit, like what we're trying to achieve with Gigable, which will span across independent work, all kinds of work, actually, then the score and the profile that you have in our platform will be far more powerful than what you have in LinkedIn. Far more powerful if we
A complete picture off. Over time.
Complete picture over time.
Makes sense. And I like that a lot. Yeah.
And actually, nobody in our platform is important as well. Like no freelancer or business is searchable. So it's a private network. Which is very, very different to your public kind of a network where this is me and everybody can take a look at me. You're private in a private network. And if you apply for a gig, of course, the person or the business to which gig you've applied can see your profile, obviously. And other people would say in a group that you might join, which we're also building into the platform, is also private groups of, would say, this is the Christmas delivery driver group or something like that. If you have a restaurant.
Yeah.
You have your own little private networks in the app, which I think is also extremely powerful because...
I think that's very interesting. It's not broadcast, it's person to person and private. I like that. Yeah,
it's a private world. It's work-related and, you know, work is a very personal thing. And I think that, you know, we went, you know, say our generation particularly, you know, Facebook and everything else and Instagram, everything's kind of broadcast to the world to see. And I think there's a little bit with Generation Z statistics and research would support that there's a little bit of a pullback from that, where people are kind of more concerned with smaller groups of friends that are close and meaningful and smaller groups of colleagues. We're talking about work here, obviously, not friend groups, colleague groups and professional networks that are private and linked and really capturing, like, the platform has a real opportunity, I think. And, you know, obviously this is what excites me most about it. Like, looking at it, what we do right now is just, it's like not even the tip of the iceberg. It's like a tiny little speck on the tip of the iceberg of what we could do and what we're striving to achieve. But there's such a huge opportunity there to build a work level private network that captures everything from your identity to the type of work you want to do, to building artificial intelligence in down the road that would help guide your career and guide the kind of independent work that you can do and achieve, regardless of whether it's here or globally. We want to open up the network globally as well. And the ability to be paid and to be paid in a really, really easy way, whether it's, you know, for the actual work itself or to you know, for your tax or into a savings account or whatever like that, linking into all of the open banking systems that are out there. You know, there's a lot of open banking happening right now, driven by EU, to be fair, driven by EU regulations that allow, you know, companies and businesses to really build out that element of what they're providing as a service in terms of, you know, the payments piece.
We talked about Revolut there and we had a coffee last week. I think things like that, there's certain technologies and businesses that come along that push things on 5 years. Like, I think, you know, Uber, for all its bad press, was one. Airbnb was another. Deliveroo was another. I think they just break apart. A lot of the stuff that been, like, banks are still so difficult to deal with. If I need to send you money, I have to get your IBAN, then I have to get my little AIB widget, or the widgets at home, can't pay until tomorrow. Whereas if I owe you 20 quid now, I can get on my phone and Revolut 20 quid. Yeah. I think that mindset is instant.
Yeah.
People go, I get it.
Yeah.
20 quid, grand. Okay, why can't I get paid like that?
Yeah.
Why can't my wages be like that?
Yeah, and Revolut,
and that's
really
going to break things apart.
100%. Revolut are way ahead in general on that stuff. So they've created their whole digital banking system. And there are others as well that are in the market, like digital banks, I suppose, or digital payment services, whatever you want to call them. But, like, basically, I just view that as it's a service. Like, it's basically another service. You know what I mean? It's not something that we shouldn't, like, make it something bigger than it is. I finished a gig. I want my money now. I don't want you to give me cash out of the till because it's outside the system and that's what we're trying to get away from.
People don't want cash anymore.
So it's like, pay me now in the app and I want to have it to use right now, straight away, instantaneously, the way you would. Like, WeChat was a huge influencer to me as well. Okay. Like, everything, because they had no credit card network in China, they needed to create. They skipped, like, you know, decades of development in China in many respects, but particularly in payments, because they had no credit card networks. They didn't want the credit card companies in. So they built networks on top of mobile apps, basically. So it was like everybody pays for goods and services in China with WeChat. Like I was there and I couldn't buy something like in a restaurant. I had to buy like a preloaded card to pay for my meal because I didn't have a WeChat bank account to pay. They only accepted WeChat payments. And that was normal in
Beijing.
That's
amazing.
I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. Like we're way behind here in many respects because we kind of were hanging on to the old systems.
Yeah. But they're so ingrained as well.
They're so ingrained. And there'll be a transition period there for sure.
I was in a cafe, name escapes me now. A new cafe in Dublin in the last couple of weeks, and it was card only.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, brilliant.
Yeah.
It makes total sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like when new businesses start, it's like you, blank slate, how should we do this?
Yeah.
We've no notions of preconceived notions. Exactly. We've no legacy issues. You see that with big companies. I was listening to a different podcast last week, and they were talking about why big companies are under such pressure. Because of such legacy issues, legacy yeah. IT systems, legacy, this is how we've always done it situations. Yeah. You know, I met a guy last week and he was talking about, he still has employees from like 20 years ago when they were using a certain machine.
Yeah.
The machine has now been replaced 10 times.
Yeah.
But he still has the guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like there's banana stuff like that. That still exists in the world that we think we all I fall into that trap, and I'm sure you do as well. You think in perfects, going, well, that business must be like this because that makes total sense. Mm-hmm. You forget about all these old systems that are still embedded in companies.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's part of the challenge that we face in Gigable, you know, on a day-to-day basis is here's a new system. Mm-hmm. You know, it perfectly complements what you already do. It's just way easier and way cleaner and way more organized. And people get it, but it takes time because, you know, people are busy. They've got a lot going on. They don't really want to learn about something new, you know, whether it's better for their business or not, or better for their work life or whatever the case may be.
Fear as well.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's, I think it's like, it's an important thing as well. Like you don't really want to be kind of in the mindset of like being proven right. You know, I'm always kind of being careful of that as well. Like I hate kind of going into a conversation where I can't wait to be proven right about what I'm saying right now. Because that's a really easy mindset to fall into because you think you know more than everybody else and you become arrogant or whatever. Really what you're talking about is what's the truth? What is truthfully the better way of doing things? And people don't want to know the truth because it involves work and thinking about it.
I saw that on Twitter last night. It's so funny. I'm trying to remember the account. I think it's Wall Street Bets or Wall Street Boys.
Right.
It's one of these like, you know, it's a really good account, but it's like never argue with someone to prove your point. Just because you know you're right.
Right.
All they'll remember is that you made them feel stupid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it was a really good point because like sometimes you do get into that. No, but this is wrong. You're wrong about that because of this. And they're like, they'll never remember what you taught them. They'll only remember that you made them feel stupid.
Yeah, exactly. What is it that they say? It's not what you say, it's what people hear. So
yeah.
you need to be kind of mindful of that as well. That you could end up... you could just come across completely wrong with the best intentions, you know? So if you just have a dedication to truth as opposed to being right, it's a very, very different conversation. You know what I mean? And it's much more open-minded kind of a stance to take in any kind of a, you know, be it in businesses or conversations like this. You know what I mean? It's not coming at it from the perspective of, I already know what the right thing is. It's, you know, it's an open-minded approach of let's discover what the truthful way is or the right way to do this that works for everybody, you know?
Work on so teeth.
Yeah, it's a different kind of
we'll wrap it up on that. I've one last question for you.
Yeah.
What book would you recommend? Every week we give away a book.
Mm-hmm.
All people have to do to win it is tag myself on social media and tag Gigable. So what's the Gigable handle?
On Instagram?
On any of them.
Gigable_work.
Gigable_work. So where can people actually learn more about Gigable? Because I'm sure there's people listening all over Ireland to be interested.
Sure. Yeah, it's HTTPS /gigable.com.
Oh, very precise.
There we go. That's the army coming out again. So, you know, I have to give you the full thing there. So gigable.com is where you can find out about us. We're on all social media, Gigable Work. You'll find us there, Instagram, Facebook. Looking to publish more blogs on LinkedIn as well. So you can find me on LinkedIn, John Peter Ryan, linkedin.com/John Peter Ryan is me. So posting more of my thoughts and kind of views on developments in the gig economy, which are rapid and frequent at the moment. So yeah, if you want to learn more about what I'm thinking or saying there, connect to me on LinkedIn, and I'm always happy to meet up with other entrepreneurs or other people in whatever, want to have a chat anytime that I'm free, I'll give it to people when I can.
Class. Brilliant. I'm actually doing a new podcast called The Ideas Lab. We're going to do that every fortnight about trends.
Okay.
So basically idea for trends, trying to give people business ideas so that we'll talk about new trends. I'm actually going to get you back if you have time and do one on the sharing economy in the next couple of months.
That'd be pretty cool.
To win a book, tag Gigable and tag Mr. Gary Fox on social media. Can be anything, LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, whatever you like. Just share the episode with yourself. What book has made an impact on you?
So I thought about this a lot because you did flag this as this is the one question you did flag, and thank you.
It's most important part of the whole pod.
Yeah, and thank you again for the open conversation and for allowing me to digress into various different.
I love it. It's the best part of my week. I get to sit down and chat to people like you. So thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, appreciate it. So so the book that I'm going to recommend is Simon Sinek's Start with Why. And the reason is I assumed recently when speaking to a group of people actually in business and kind of entrepreneurship, and I was thinking, everybody's read Start With Why, right? And like basically one hand had gone up in a room of 10 people or something. And I was like, wow, everybody hasn't read this book. Everybody needs to read that book. Everybody, even if you're not going to start your own business, definitely that book. It's so simple and so eloquently. It's so eloquent.
That's the key, I think. Yeah.
It really is. It's just a masterclass in delivering one message perfectly well. And to just like, there's just no arguing with it. What he says in that book is just, you can't debate it. It's really, really important. And I would recommend anybody to read that book. So that's my recommendation.
Start with Why.
Start with that. Yeah. Start with that book. Definitely.
Excellent. John, thank you so much.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Thanks again.
And that was episode 34 with John Ryan from Gigable. I hope you enjoyed it. As ever, if you did, please do share it on social media or just share it with your friends, pass the pod. It helps massively just to spread the message. Even if you don't want to win the book, I'd appreciate it if you do share the podcast along. Just tag me along and just do get in touch. A lot of people have gotten in touch in the last couple of weeks just with feedback. Always looking as well as to how I can improve it. So if you are enjoying it, but there's something you'd like to see on it or something you'd like to add to it or questions you'd like to ask specific guests, do get in touch. All the channels are open, so LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, whatever, you can email me either. So that is episode 34. If you do want to win the book, Start With Why by Simon Sinek, simply tag me, Mr. Gary Fox, and tag Gigable. They're across all social channels. Just do make sure you tag us if you want to win the book. That's episode 34. If you do want to come along to Entrepreneur Experiment Live on December 4th in Dublin City Centre with me, Devin Hughes, and Gareth Flower, do go to my website, mrgaryfox.com. Sign up for tickets there. They're free. They are limited in numbers, though. That is it for episode 34. I'll see you next week, Thursday at 6 a.m. Thanks for listening.